is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We will discuss a lawsuit against the Baton Rouge Catholic Diocese, which raises issues for both the church and a young woman who says she told a priest about being molested as a child by a fellow parishioner. What obligation does a priest have to report allegations of wrongdoing said under the seal of confession? Our guests are slated to include the director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, David Closey, and attorney Mike Wolf. This case could have national implications. Also on the show, we are scheduled to hear from Susie Parker with a most provocative book, Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. A story that has been in our midst for a week or so regarding the Diocese of Baton Rouge, the Catholic Diocese, is one of national import, raising issues for both the church and the woman, young woman, who says she told a priest about being molested as a child by a fellow parishioner. A legal battle has ensued over whether the priest, Jeff Bae, should have reported the teenager's claims of sexual abuse. It's pitting state laws meant to protect children against the age-old secrecy surrounding confessions in the church. 297-5633. It's a sensitive topic, and we will handle it as best we can. And we have two gentlemen and maybe more, but we're starting with Mike Wolf, the well-known attorney, and David Closey, who is director of a group called Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And David is quoted in a story that ran in Sunday's Advocate, a well-done story written by Heidi Kinchin, and David is the executive director of SNAP. He says priests should not be shocked if courts are increasingly unwilling to recognize a privilege that allows the church to potentially mask abuse. But this is a case involving not only the Catholic Church, it can involve any religious organization in which a parishioner confesses to somebody who's the head of the congregation. The implications are potentially widespread. David Closey, your analysis of the decision by the Louisiana Supreme Court, which was 6-1 against the diocese and Father Bae, do you think it was an appropriate judgment by the High Court of our state?
Well, Jim, SNAP is a support group, and we try to be a welcoming place for everybody who is victimized by clergy, whether they're atheists or whether they're daily communicants. So we don't take a formal position, you know, on this court case. But I will say that, you know, many constitutional rights that we have in this country are very precious. At the same time, it's hard to imagine anything more precious than the safety of children from child molesters. And we believe that church officials have abused their power so much in this ongoing scandal, that perhaps it is time for us to think about whether or not some of that power should be taken away from them. I know that may sound harsh, but you know, we treasure the right to vote, but we forbid felons from voting. And we treasure free speech, but we don't let people yell fire in a crowded theater. And maybe we should think, given how widespread child sex abuse is, maybe we should think about putting the rights of the actual safety of children above the beliefs of adults.
Well, Louisiana's Children's Code says members of the clergy, including priests, rabbis, and other ordained ministers of faith, are mandatory reporters of suspected abuse. But that law does provide an exception when the allegations of abuse are the subject of a confidential religious communication. And that would, of course, seemingly include the seal of confession. The law states also that notwithstanding any claim of privileged communication, any mandatory reporter who has cause to believe that a child's physical or mental health or welfare is endangered must report that information to the proper authorities. So seemingly a contradictory law. And the state Supreme Court has overturned the First Circuit Court of Appeal, which resolved the conflict in the Children's Code by saying the priest's status as a mandatory reporter is determined by the context in which he learns of the abuse. If the information comes only during confession, the priest is not a mandatory reporter and is not required to contact authorities. That was from the First Circuit. The state Supreme Court disagreed, and as a result, the Catholic Church is now weighing its options for appeal of the state Supreme Court ruling, in this case involving Father Jeff Bai, who's been on this show before. Now, why does the priest have to report it, David? Couldn't this young woman have gone to the authorities? Couldn't she have come forward herself? Why is it incumbent for the priest to reveal any alleged abuse?
Well, realistically, precious few children are strong enough and savvy enough to understand that they have been or being hurt and that they will be believed if they come forward to police and prosecutors. Let me ask you this. When was the last time you saw a story about a 6-year-old or a 10-year-old who, you know, leaves their home and goes down to the police precinct and says, my stepfather's molesting me? You know, it just very rarely happens. The reason we have mandatory reporting laws that include all kinds of professions is because we as a civilized society have recognized that child predators are shrewd and cunning and powerful individuals, and that kids are extremely vulnerable and very confused when abuse happens and filled with shame and self-blame. So it's possible that she could have, but we in society have valued children to the extent that we say we're not leaving them alone to the wolves to fend for themselves, but we're going to require smart adults to take affirmative steps to protect kids when kids are in danger.
Well, the person who makes the claim, the young woman, contends that the parishioner, who is now deceased, began emailing her when he was 64 and she was 14, that he ultimately kissed her and fondled her, and she sought spiritual guidance from Father Bai on the matter on 3 occasions in the confessional. And as a result, the claim is that Father Bai should have reported this, and he, as a priest, says he could not, even if he wanted to, because he would face eternal damnation and excommunication. And that's the age-old quandary involving cases of this kind. And as a result, we're going to have more legal skirmishing on this front. And once again, Baton Rouge is at the center of the universe. David Clossy with us, the executive director of SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, and attorney Michael Wolf. And as I invited Mike, I invited him because of his legal mind. I don't know that what his position is on the Supreme Court's ruling, but it was a 6-1 judgment against the Diocese of Baton Rouge. Mike Wolf, I think this is particularly relevant too. I must say, I am a Roman Catholic. David, are you?
I was raised Catholic, but I'm not Catholic now.
Okay, and Mike Wolf?
Similarly, I'm raised Catholic, but I'm not anymore.
You're not anymore. But what's your take on the Supreme Court ruling, Mike?
Well, it's important to understand the procedural nature of the case. I think the Supreme Court ruling was reasonable. It was a per curiam decision. That means it wasn't announced who wrote it, and it doesn't even give the vote in the decision itself. But the problem was that the trial judge said that the priest was not a mandatory reporter, a priest in a confessional context. He was not required under the Children's Code to report knowledge of dangerous abuse. And the church, this was a suit in which the child, through her parents, were suing the church, the priest, and the alleged perpetrator, who has since died. And so the church was a defendant, and they filed a motion in limine, which is an evidentiary motion to restrict the nature of the proof that can be produced, and saying that they should not be required, and the priest in particular, Father Bai, should not be required to give any information that he received during the confession. the court denied that motion, the trial court did, and said we have to see what the facts are. Because, as you say, there's a possible conflict in the Children's Code in that it says that a priest is a mandatory reporter. But it also says that there's an exception for statements given under the seal of the confession. In this case, this Mayu versus Charlet case, it's unclear whether the priest had knowledge other than from the confessional context. So that's an example of one of the factual issues that needed to be resolved before the court could rule on liability. So the Court of Appeal disagreed with the trial court and gave greater protection to the privilege of the confessional in the Catholic Church, and said the priest was not required to report and there could be no effective claim against the priest. So they granted a peremptory exception. That means they dismissed the claim as to the priest and the church. Then the Supreme Court simply said, reversed the Court of Appeal and went back to the decision of the trial court and said, it depends on the individual facts. We must find out what, one point is clear. They have said that the confessional seal is not absolute. If a priest in a confessional learns of serious danger to a child or abuse of a child, that's the key thing, it must be reported.
All right, do you think the court made the right call on this?
Yes, I do. I think it was clearly right, yes, because the obviously the civil safety of the community must prime the
All
church
right.
doctrine.
Well, what happens if, for you as a lawyer, Mike, what happens if a young girl comes in and says she's been abused and this is a client of yours? Does the attorney-client privilege hold, or do you have to report this?
The privilege parallels that of the priest-penitent privilege. Also, it applies to a healthcare provider and a patient. There's a big difference between reporting a previous conduct and threatened future conduct. That's the big difference. No, neither a priest nor a healthcare provider nor a lawyer is required to. In fact, they have a privilege. The defendant has the privilege that his confidential communications not be disclosed. But if he tells someone, "I'm about to go kill my wife," then that person who received that communication is obliged to take action to protect that person. So that's a big difference about whether the action
was not,
in question.
That was not what happened here, though.
That's right.
This was a case in which the assailant allegedly kissed the 14-year-old girl and touched her.
Yes, and she was not a defendant, right? She was.
But if somebody comes to your office and says, "This is what happened, and I'm concerned that this is going to continue to happen unless some kind of action is taken," as a lawyer, are you required by the state to do what is demanded from the high court from Father Bai?
I don't believe a lawyer is defined as a mandatory.
Well, why would it be different from a lawyer than for a priest?
I think because in effect, it'll come to the same thing, but the lawyers are always consulted when there is wrongdoing, and maybe a priest would too. But it's just more common. The legal community is, and the courts are more familiar with the protection, the privilege afforded for attorney-client communications. And it's just elementary, so elementary that it doesn't occur to one to demand a lawyer to report on his client in general.
Well, the same would, I'm sure, be said if Father Bai were here. He would say that I have the same privilege that a lawyer does, that this is something between me and the confessor. And I, as a oath of the church, I cannot divulge this. I have said that everything that happens in the confessional is confidential. Just as you, as a lawyer, when you're representing a client, you have the same kind of requirements.
Yes, and I think the Supreme Court has reasonably said that it must depend on the facts of the situation. Now, the penalties. They're just misdemeanor criminal penalties for violating the statute as far as not reporting abuse. Another issue in the case here was, as I mentioned, the trial court said that, or the Court of Appeals said there could be no cause of action against a priest in a case like this. And the Supreme Court said, no, we cannot do that absolutely. Now, and they said, there's in general, in under our Louisiana law, anytime someone is injured by another, he has a cause of action. So they said, if the priest did injure this person, then we can produce evidence of it in court.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. The Reverend Jim Weiner, quoted in the Advocate Sunday, rectory president of the Notre Dame Seminary in New Orleans, said the seal of confession is not the priest to break, no matter what the circumstances. We'll discuss it more in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. A bit more time with David Clossy, National Director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, the nation's largest and oldest self-help group for clergy molestation victims, and Mike Wolf, the attorney, libertarian, longtime activist, and he is a great legal mind, and it's good to get his take on this Supreme Court decision, which does not involve, I must say, has no involvement at all in anybody abused by a priest, but it does involve a confession made to a priest about alleged molestation. Bill Donahue of the Catholic League of America, he has issued a statement saying, a 14-year-old girl alleges she told her parish priest that she was being abused by a now-deceased lay member of the parish. The girl alleges the disclosures came during the sacrament of confession. Now her parents are suing the priest, the Diocese of Baton Rouge, for failing to report the alleged abuse. The state Supreme Court has ruled that the priest, Father Jeff Bayh, may be compelled to testify as to whether the confessions took place, and if so, what the contents of any such confessions were. Confession is one of the most sacred rites in the church. The sacrament is based on a belief that the seal of the confessional is absolute and complete. A priest is never permitted to disclose the contents of any confession or even allowed to disclose that an individual did seek the sacrament. A priest who violates that seal suffers automatic excommunication from the church. As a result of this ruling, Father Bayh may now have to choose between violating his sacred duty as a priest and being excommunicated from the church, or refusing to testify and risk going to prison. And Father Bayh has said he will not testify. The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protects free exercise of religion, and it goes on for there saying the Catholic League supports Father Bayh and the diocese of Baton Rouge in their quest for a reversal of this ruling, a recognition that clergy cannot be forced to violate their faith. Arlene in St. Francisville. Good morning, Arlene. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Jim. I would just like to ask why no one has looked at this as this child was not confessing. She was just using the confessional as an access to the priest to ask for help. Is my interpretation.
That may be true, but it happened in the confessional, so it doesn't really matter what the situation was.
Well, that sounds like stretching a point to me when it's a child seeking help.
Okay. But, well, Arlene, it's good that you call. Is a woman, and our guests are two males, as am I, but apparently several other adults, including some of those related to the young lady, were privileged to this knowledge as well of the alleged abuse. Why didn't they go to the authorities?
Are you putting that?
Yeah. Why do you think?
I can't imagine. I think it is a good question to know what went on all of that time before, but I can't imagine why they didn't if they knew what was going on with her.
All right. So, thank you, Arlene. David, what do you think? Adults knew of this, and they did not go, and yet they're saying Father Bayh should have gone down to the police station. Why him rather than those closest to the young lady?
Well, certainly anybody who suspects abuse or knows of abuse should call 911. There's no exception. And I can't speak for those other people. I also do think, though, that while there may be multiple wrongdoers here, Father Bayh as a priest, as a spiritual figure, does have a higher duty than most. And I think it's important to keep in mind the real life context in which this happens, right? Over the last 30 years, Catholic officials admit that there are more than 6,000 proven, admitted, and credibly accused predator priests.
Well, that is a different issue than this.
Well, it is.
I hate to mix the two.
Well, but I just want to say that I can easily imagine justices of the Louisiana Supreme Court saying, you know, we've seen the devastation that comes with keeping secrets about abuse.
But shouldn't that be irrelevant to this argument? That has nothing to do with this, does it?
Well, church officials have repeatedly abused the confessional privilege. They have had conversations with victims and witnesses and whistleblowers about abuse that did not take place in the confessional booth, and yet church officials have claimed these were, in fact, confessions.
Well, but that's not alleged here.
Well, I don't know physically where it took place, where the actual conversation took
place. Well, I think we're talking about apples and oranges, and you have a very good point about alleged abuse in the church, and more than alleged abuse, real abuse, and it's been horrible, and Father Bailly has even been on this show and talked about the terrible stain on the church, and the inexcusable, and that is one issue, but in this case, it seems to involve simply a case of whether or not Father Bailly has to say what occurred in the confessional, and I know him well enough. He'll go to prison if he has to.
Well, there does seem to be, to me at least, an easy answer here, and that is that Father Bailly could disclose the conversation voluntarily. His bishop could seek excommunication, and the Pope could issue a pardon and keep him in the priesthood. That seems to me to be the easy way out for the church, but I do think that we as a society have to look at this broader issue and say there are exceptions to almost every other constitutional right that we enjoy. Why should this one privilege be so sacrosanct as to have no exceptions whatsoever, even if it involves the safety of a kid? I think that's the larger issue.
All right, well, reporters are often under the same kind of dictates, and the laws, of course, are less murky in protecting reporters, even though there's a First Amendment. There's a reporter now for the New York Times who may very well go to jail soon because of not revealing sources. And you talked about the obligation that a priest has and maybe the obligation that a reporter has. As a reporter, the first obligation is to the truth and to protect our sources. Now, a priest, his first obligation is to what he deems his creator, God Almighty, and he takes this oath, and he says, I will never tell what happens in the confessional. Well, never means never. Mike Wolfe, you were a Catholic. I'm sure you probably went to confession once or twice. What if a priest came out and said, Mike told me this, that, and the other?
Of course, that's totally not allowed, and it conflicts with the First Amendment to not allow a sacrament like that of penance in the Catholic Church to be carried out. I think one point that should be mentioned as far as the possible inconsistency in the Children's Code, it does give an exception for statements given under the seal of the confessional, but it also says that in those cases, the priest or clergyman must recommend to the communicant that they contact the civil authorities. So there is a that statement in there. But another big thing in this case, though, is we have to look at for potential for future abuse, for ongoing abuse. In this case, apparently, it was not very significant. There was a matter of telephone calls and emails. It was said that in the course of this 64-year-old's attempt to contact the 14-year-old, the most that ever happened was at one point he kissed her and touched her through her clothes, it was said. Now, we don't know the details of that, but there is no showing, apparently, that she was in dire danger of future abuse of any kind. And that should be going to the balance of weighing whether a priest should be required to break the seal of the confessional. And as you say, of course, he can always risk contempt and simply be silent, as I'm sure Father Bailly would.
Okay. Derek Arbor writes, was the priest under a vow of silence, since it wasn't the perpetrator of the crime but the victim in confession? And he says it was not a sin she was confessing. Was the priest able to tell authorities and chose not to, or was he bound by his oath to silence? And I think that's a good question, but Jeff Bailly would say he was bound by his oath to silence.
Yes, and it appears that she was using the confessional as an opportunity to seek counseling on this matter.
So where do you think this is going, David Clossy? I had a conversation yesterday with the gentleman I quoted earlier from the Catholic League, Bill Donahue, and he says he's very confident the church will win on appeal. Of course, that's what you would think he would say, but it is an interesting legal question, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. It certainly is. And if I had to bet, I would bet that
that Bill is right. We do in this country really, really regard as untouchable any perceived government interference in religious matters. But I do think it's a question that's worth asking. You know, are there? And I guess the other point I would like to make too is that, you know, oftentimes where there's a will, there's a way. I've read accounts that say that the priest actually said to the girl, "This is your burden. Don't tell anybody." If that's true, that's a terrible, terrible message to send to a child who's being abused, whether the abuse is involves penetration or not, whether it was a one-time incident or likely to be repeated. It's a terrible message. And I do think that even in the context of confession, priests can learn things that they can bring up in other contexts with the same individual and prod them, like your other guest pointed out, prod them to take steps to protect themselves and protect others by calling law enforcement.
All right, we're going to have a few other inquiries. Here's one online. If this goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, 6 of the justices on the High Court are Roman Catholic, David. It would seem that the deck would be stacked in that case. It's kind of hard to put these beliefs aside when something like this is before you. It would be curious to see how Justice Scalia, for example, would rule on a case like this.
Yes, I would hope that the justices would be able to be impartial, but religion is near and dear to people's hearts. But I guess I would submit again that children's safety should be as well, and if there's a conflict between the two, we really should think long and hard before we automatically assume that what adults believe is always more valuable to preserve than the safety of boys and girls from child molesters.
Reginald on Gardia. Reginald, good morning. You're on the air with Mike Wolf and David Clossy. Hi, Reginald.
Hi, Jim. I have a question, I believe, maybe for the lawyer. I think, and I'm going from television shows, usually when there is evidence that was gained unlawfully or without a warrant, that evidence, the judge throws out that evidence and requires the investigators to find other evidence. Why not just find other evidence?
Well, we were talking about that is a live issue here. There was information about this so-called relationship between the older man and the young girl from other sources than the information imparted in the confessional, and that could be looked into. Again, in this case, realize what the Supreme Court was doing. They simply said, we're not going to allow a priest to say out of hand, under no circumstances can I be forced to speak of what happened in the confessional. That's the motion in limine that had been rejected by the trial court and yet reversed by the Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court was going back to the first situation. And the other is, could there ever be a claim against a priest for not reporting a knowledge of serious abuse that he gained in the confessional? And they said, no, we're not going to put an absolute rule on it. We're going to let it yield to the facts of a given case. So I think the U.S. Supreme Court would uphold the Louisiana Supreme Court on this matter.
Dylan, a listener, he notes that this is hearsay. As other listeners have noted, this was not a confession. This was a revelation about an alleged attack from somebody else. So Father Bailly is hearing from one side in this case too. He's not getting a complete picture. So what should he have gone to the alleged perpetrator?
Well, that's correct. And by the way, there is an evidentiary privilege. The rule that the seal of the confessional can't be broken generally, and it applies also to the lawyer-client privilege and the doctor-patient privilege, is one that prevents the person who received the communication that was in the professional relationship with the other person, the witness, to be forced to testify. In other words, it's a privilege of the defendant, typically, and it can be asserted by the priest or the penitent in this case, but that's a very limited matter. That's different from being told you can't say anything about reporting serious abuse.
It's a story that's got legs, so I'm sure we'll have a occasion to revisit it, and quite likely we'll be calling on Mike Wolf and David Clossy again. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us today and discussing the most sensitive of sensitive issues.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Bye-bye. 297-5633, 877-217-5757, and we switch gears, and we're joined by another provocative guest, Susie Parker. Her book is Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt. Good morning, Susie Parker.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, your own sex scandal prompted you to investigate the secret sex lives of others in your native Dixie. What happened to you, Susie?
I don't know if it was a sex scandal in the vein of like a Monica Lewinsky, but I had written about sex for a national publication, and then I got banned from being a political commentator on a local television political show.
On public broadcasting in Arkansas, right?
That's right, no doubt, public broadcasting.
Well,
they call that irony.
Well, why was your revelation so bad that you couldn't be on the air anymore?
Well, that's always been kind of a murky story. I'm not really sure. They said that I had written about sex and that I was banned from the station, and I thought they just meant by for a week, because that's kind of how it works sometimes. Like if you were controversial. If you had written something controversial as a journalist, you might be, you know, banned for a week or two. But I guess they meant forever, because I've never been invited back.
And
which is okay with me.
You write this book, Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt. And, of course, you are right in the heart of the Bible Belt. Arkansas, unlike Louisiana, does not have a heavy Catholic population. And most of the people there profess to be Baptist or some other Protestant denomination, and most don't talk a whole lot about their sex lives, but you say there's a whole lot going on behind closed doors.
There is, yes, I think there is. I traveled 10 states for this book, interviewing people about their sex lives and their fetishes, and I think that the Bible Belt breeds a certain repression that other areas of the country do not, you know, such as the East and West Coast, and I think a big part of that is religion.
Well, yeah, and when something is repressed, sometimes it's all the more enticing, isn't it?
That's it. That's exactly it. And eventually it bubbles to the surface, and that's why we see, I think, a lot of politicians and sex scandals. And this, the political aspect of this isn't just Southern. You know, that's kind of more of a national epidemic among both Republicans and Democrats. But, when you repress something, it becomes more tempting.
And you wrote your book after the Lewinsky scandal, but of course the President of the United States is he's one of those Protestants who occasionally dallied with somebody who was not his wife.
And from Arkansas, no doubt.
We'll return with Susie Parker. Her book is Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Our guest is Susie Parker, Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt. It was 13 years ago that Susie wrote an article about a night she had after sampling an aphrodisiac drink, and because of the article, Parker was booted from a public television show where she was a regular commentator in Arkansas and was entangled in a lawsuit against the drink's manufacturer. And she ended up writing about her experiences and going to 10 states in the South and looking at what's going on behind closed doors, in some cases not behind closed doors, but despite the lip service we give to being God-fearing and Bible-thumping and faithful to our significant others in the South. It appears there's a whole lot of action going on, Susie Parker.
There is. Lots of action behind closed doors. You summed it up.
Uh-huh. Nicholas Son Nicholson says, is it true that the highest divorce rate is among Southern Baptists?
I believe that is still true. And at one point, and I'm not sure about the statistics now, but Arkansas had one of the highest rates.
Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Arkansas, the home of William Jefferson Clinton, who's a Southern Baptist.
Correct.
And
the former president.
That's right. And like Jimmy Carter, he professes to be born again. And there's so many people who chuckle when they hear that. But I do think Bill Clinton, in his own way, is an extremely religious person. He just happens to fall prey to sins of the flesh every now and then.
Yeah, I think Southerners are very good at putting their lives in compartments. I found that when I was interviewing people for this book, it's almost like it's a split personality, where they can, if they think they go, you know, if they go to church every Sunday and they profess to be religious and they are religious, but somehow they have this double personality where they can put that, you know, that in a box, and then they feel like it's okay to sin and repent and sin again.
Well,
it's a cycle.
I do think that the more things are repressed, and this is true through the ages, the more deviance we have, deviance from the so-called norm. But when we're talking about sex, the norm is a matter of opinion. But and we're going to keep this at an adult level, but in your travels across the South, you ran into some interesting people. Who was the most interesting?
The most interesting had to be a man that I met in Tennessee who had a most curious fetish that I didn't know existed until I started writing this book. I mean, we know people's fetishes. They, you know, some people are into bondage, some people are into swinging, going to strip clubs, but this man was into something called pony play, where he would dress up, and he's not alone by any means. This is a huge subculture out there.
You're kidding me.
I'm not.
Huh.
I'm not. And it's not just in the South. I mean, it's very huge in on the coast, but he would dress up like a horse, literally, with a tail and, you know, the bridle, the whole thing, and he would, and women, mostly, yeah, women, would get on his shoulders, imagine, like, you know, a cheerleader.
All right, I think I get the picture.
You get it.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, that's all it is. There's no sex involved. It's just that is the fetish.
And a
big part of it is the dressing up.
Gets excited out of pretending to be a pony.
Yes. Okay. As I learned in this book, as someone told me, your kink's not my kink, but your kink is okay.
Well, something like that, as long as it involves adults, is relatively harmless. So
that's how I look at it. If that's you're an adult, two adults, if that's what you want to be into, then that's your privilege.
Well, you found some interesting people, and including the guy who pretended he was a pony. There was a guy, a computer programmer in Arkansas, right? Who by day is a very meticulous, proper person, and at night he became the skirt man of Arkansas.
He did, yeah. He was actually kind of the skirt man during the day too, when he could get by with it. He later got in. He later went to prison for underage sex. So years later, after my book came out.
Well, let's go to Tampa, Florida.
Tampa. Okay.
Yeah, the Iron Bells. Who are the Iron Bells?
Yeah, Tampa. The Iron Bells are these women who are bodybuilders. And that's, you know, that's their hobby, and men pay them to be thrown around by them. That's a very strange chapter. the iron bells. Some men enjoy, and when I say men, it could also be women, but the majority of things I found was men with the iron bells. Some men like to watch these iron bells crush cereal boxes with their legs.
Okay.
Now, I did not see this happen, but they came up more than once during interviews.
297-5633 for the provocative Susie Parker, Pride of Little Rock. Did you get any?
I don't know about the Pride of Little Rock. That's pretty funny.
Well, believe me, I've interviewed Connie Hamsey, and you're a lot tamer.
Oh, yes.
Than
me too. I once went to her apartment for an interview, and her wallpaper of rock stars was something to behold.
And she claims to have gotten acquainted with many of these people.
Many. She had one room that was completely wallpapered from floor to ceiling with photos of herself with rock stars.
And you know what, Susie? I believe her.
Oh, I believe her too.
877-217-5757, and let's keep this on an adult level. Susie's a fun guest, and let's not take advantage of the situation, because obviously this is adult material at 9:48 in the morning and 8:48 at night if you're listening to the repeat of this program. Dan in Spanish Town. Dan, you're on the air with Susie Parker, the author of Sex in the South.
Hello, Susie. The book sounds really good.
Thanks.
Yeah, my question is, Jim, you never explained what a skirt woman is, or a skirt man, or...
The skirt man of Little Rock, the computer programmer?
What does that deal? What does he do?
I think he dresses in women's clothing, doesn't he? Isn't that what he did?
Yeah, but he's different than... and he doesn't really do this as much anymore since his scandal, but he didn't describe himself as a transvestite or a drag queen or anything like that. His deal was he would normally dress pretty, you know, shirt and tie on top, and then these mini skirts or kilts at the bottom. And he had great legs, so his legs were envious of everybody wanted his legs because he worked out. But in a southern city, that just, you stand out. You know, if he was in New York or L.A., nobody would pay attention to him.
But in Tennessee?
But in Little Rock.
In Little Rock, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right there on Main Street, I'm sure.
Right, yes.
Okay.
He was well known.
His
attire.
Speaking of Bill Clinton, you went to Jennifer Flowers' bar. Was that in New Orleans?
That was. It's not no longer there, but it was there.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. Mm-hmm. Across from Antoine's, in fact, Bill Clinton had lunch with a friend of mine at Antoine's several years ago, and he walks outside after having lunch, and he sees Jennifer Flowers, and he's like, let's get out of here fast, please, and he did, but there's very little doubt. In fact, he even admitted it under oath after denying it on 60 Minutes that he and Miss Flowers, that's Jennifer with a G, used to have liaisons at the Quapaw Towers there in Little Rock, and Jennifer was on the air with me one time and said the governor of Arkansas, who became the president of the United States, used to climb the fire escape to rendezvous with her at the Quapaw Towers.
I believe that. I know I know somebody who lived at the Quapaw Towers during that time who was a friend of my father's, and I heard about it back in the 80s when it was happening. And then it all, you know, rolled out when he ran for president.
And for those who may not know, the Quapaw Towers is located adjacent to the interstate through Little Rock. So it's quite possible somebody could have been driving down the interstate and seen the governor of Arkansas scaling the building to rendezvous with his mistress, Jennifer with a G, Flowers. But
and ironically, that building now sets, the Clinton Presidential Library sets catty corner to that building.
I know. And Clinton has a penthouse apartment at the library too.
He does.
So he can look
straight across and see the Quapaw Towers.
And have all those fond memories of the nights with Jennifer with a G, Flowers. But what happened at her bar in New Orleans?
Well, at her bar, she hosted a gay and lesbian literary festival, which at the time was one of the few such events in New Orleans, and so it was kind of a raunchy, sexy evening, and she sung torch songs and cracked jokes about Bill Clinton.
Yeah, she was pretty good about that, much to his chagrin. But there's no doubt that she and the future president became friendly with one another. And she even said that at one point that they had a rendezvous in the bathroom at the mansion with Hillary right down the hall.
I know that one. I don't know about, but as I've learned, nothing really shocks me living in Little Rock.
And Bill Clinton, who I think history will remember as a fine president, he may not have been the finest man.
Exactly.
Depending on,
and I think that's true of many people.
Okay.
They're very good at, you know, their day jobs, but they have these secret lives.
Okay. Well, no doubt about it. He's emblematic of many men, and he also is a symbolic of the South. He grew up in Hot Springs, and Hot Springs in his day, and to some degree even today, but more so back in the 50s and 60s, it was a place where you would literally have a casino and a church on the same block. So he grew up in that kind of environment where you had the good, the bad, and the ugly all right there, right together.
Right, and that, I think that's what fuels a lot, because we have so many churches on every corner in the South, and I think that fuels that double personality I was talking about, that kind of split personality and the ability to put your two lives in compartments.
297-5633, in our remaining moments with Susie Parker, the book Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt, a comment from Rick Causey. He says it's much more of a David Lynch world out there than it is a Brady Bunch world.
Oh, I often say that I reside in Twin Peaks, so that's very accurate.
And the people on the Brady Bunch, in their personal lives, they were quite a risque bunch as well.
That's correct. That's correct. The father ended up coming out of the closet. There was that rumor, or I guess it's not even a rumor, about Florence Henderson and
Barry
Rick
Williams.
Brady. So, yep.
Yeah, yeah.
What you see is never what you get, is kind of my motto.
And the young man who played Bobby Brady got arrested a few times, and he is the inspiration for our governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, changing his name to Bobby. He did it from Bobby Brady on the Brady Bunch, Susie.
Oh, that's correct, yeah.
He did, and the Brady Bunch was not exactly the kind of family that we saw on the small screen. And most of us have stories beneath the stories. Why are we fascinated with this kind of stuff?
I think that people are generally very curious about other people, or that could be just described as nosy, but we are curious about what other people are up to, and I think by reflecting on other people's lives, it makes us feel better about our own.
All right, here's a question from Jennifer asking if Connie Hamsey, the world-famous groupie that we mentioned who lives in Little Rock, still around, by the way, that did she ever have a liaison with Bill Clinton, and she says yes. In fact, she says she passed a lie detector test.
That is what she says.
So Bill Clinton's right there with many others, including Waylon Jennings and Richard Carpenter and people like that who Connie claims to have had liaisons with.
Correct. Small world.
Even Neil Diamond.
Shallow pool.
That's what she claims.
That's what she claims.
That's what she claims. But how did a guy with this kind of a past, people talk about Bobby Jindal and having, for example, he participated in an exorcism and how this is going to kill him if he runs for president. Well, Bill Clinton had all this garbage in his past, and yet he still became the leader of the free world. How did he do it?
It's so curious to me. Bill Clinton has an amazing way of mesmerizing people. I've seen it happen repeatedly over the years. I've covered him for decades. And he just has this way of mesmerizing, you know, people, charming them. And that's both very intriguing and a little scary. And I think that he has, people have really forgotten, you know, I had people tell me that the Monica Lewinsky, here in Little Rock, people told me after he got out of office, like in the last 10 years or so, that he didn't really have that Monica Lewinsky. None of that happened. And I said, well, yes, it did. We lived it, you know, day in, day out in the news. So it's amazing the way, it's almost like it's a Jedi mind trick that he's very good at.
Did he ever mesmerize you?
No. I have, however, said in speeches that he's given, and he has said stuff that I know is flat out not true, and I have been totally bought into it until I have to remind myself, wait a minute, you know better than that.
All right, Susie, thank you. Let's talk again. Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt, from Susie Parker, intrepid journalist from Little Rock, who went to 10 states in the South and found some things that are quite interesting. Until tomorrow, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.